It seems appropriate during a general election campaign to wonder about the future of democracy. What happened to the Athenian ideal of government of the humble, by the humble, for the humble? Have we, as some argue, even on the right, as you hear in a moment, become a plutocracy where it's government of the rich, by the rich, for the rich, and all else is window dressing, where the left has failed to create the necessary intellectual friction for political change? And is the core problem that democracy never was for and by the humble? It's actually a middle class project. And as you look around the world, the middle class is feeling besieged, poorly catered for, their prosperity threatened or not delivered on. And in some countries, the proportion of the middle classes in the population is even declining. The result perhaps being that the future of democracy is in peril. That's the position of Francis Fukuyama of the Institute for International Studies at Stanford University, author of numerous books, including The Origins of Political Order, From Pre-Human Times to the French Revolution, and many years ago now, The End of History and The Last Man. Welcome back to Late Night Live, Francis.
Thank you very much.
And also in the studio is another giant of democratic thought, John Keane, who's director of the Institute for Democracy and Human Rights at the University of Sydney, and author of the massive work, The Life and Death of Democracy, which shakes many assumptions about the origins of democracy and argues that the middle class have a different role in democracy these days. Welcome, John.
Thank you very much for having me.
So let's test the assumptions about the middle class and democracy. So you feel, Francis, that the middle class prosperity being threatened threatens democracy.
Well, I think that democracy has always been supported by having a broad middle class. The middle class does not always support democracy. So I think in China now, this rising middle class of maybe 300-400 million people is pretty content to live under the Chinese Communist Party's rule. But I think in Europe and North America, it was the fact that the working class graduated into the middle class in the course of the 19th and 20th centuries that provided a lot of legitimacy and support and stakeholdership for democratic institutions. And I think the problem that we face now is with the advance of technology and globalization, the livelihoods of a lot of this stratum of society have been disappearing. This is the story of deindustrialization. And if we end up with a meritocracy, but one that concentrates wealth and influence at the very top and leaves the job opportunities for the rest of the society up for grabs, I think that's not a healthy situation. And I think it threatens democracy by inducing populism and a lot of other problems.
So it's more, your argument is that the middle class could disappear. And I think you argue that in the United States, it is shrinking.
Well, it's shrinking. And I think it's really the advance of computers, information technology, the automation that takes away low-skilled jobs that has been really devastating cities like Detroit, which went bankrupt this summer because it's shrunk from, you know, a couple million people down to a few hundred thousand. And that's a direct symptom of this kind of middle class erosion.
John Keane, to what extent, in your view, is the middle class the core of democracy and fundamental to democracy?
The historical evidence, I think, is against the proposition that a middle class is always required for a democracy. I think that didn't apply to Athens because there was a period in which the franchise was extended downwards radically, for example, to those who rowed the warships. And it's also the case, the historical record shows, that the middle classes were promiscuous when it came to parliamentary democracy under modern conditions.
By that you mean what?
It means that they were tempted often to fall in love with state power, to go along with a fairly authoritarian state because they were frightened. They suffered a loss of confidence, a fear of their wealth. And the classic case is Weimar Germany.
Right.
And there are many cases unfolding in our time in the Asia-Pacific region where that may well turn out to be the case. So the rule is that if a strong state that generates wealth also generates a middle class, that middle class wedged between the very rich and the poor tends to go for the status quo. It tends to go for some species of authoritarianism. You can see this in Bahrain, in the Emirates, Saudi Arabia. You can see it in Brunei. You can see it in Thailand. And as Francis says, also possibly in China. That's a big test case. There were middle classes that opted for fascism. That should be kept in mind. The cases that we...
Although they did elect Hitler.
Yes, and but a very nervous, disintegrating middle class. And that's... Francis is right about this. We should be concerned about the present-day disintegration of the middle classes in the Atlantic region.
But it wasn't communism a middle-class project? And you argue, don't you, that the tendency to authoritarianism, at least on the left, was also middle class?
I think it's right that the middle class does not inevitably support democracy. What the middle class has are great expectations. And I think that you'll see that the leadership of virtually every revolution since the French Revolution, but including the Bolshevik and Chinese revolutions, has been led by middle-class individuals whose opportunities for advancement were stymied. And, you know, this was the case of people like Lenin and Mao, and also the authors of the French Revolution were mostly middle-class lawyers who felt that the old regime was keeping them back. So it's a class that I think has the wealth and the security to organize politically, to project ideas. You know, the intellectuals come out of this class. And I think the relationship to democracy really has to do with the relative proportion. And this is why having what we call a middle class society is important. Right now in China, the middle class is just a minority. You know, it's maybe 30% of the population. And underneath them, I think they fear this big mass of peasants and poor people who, if given the vote, I think would just vote to redistribute money away from the middle classes towards themselves. And that's why I think the theory is not that the middle class inevitably supports democracy, but when you get to a middle class society in which the middle classes are, you know, 80% of the population, then you don't have that fear of the poor rising up underneath you. Then I think you have a much more stable basis of support for democracy.
So what's your... Sorry, John.
I think much depends here on the definition of democracy. And broadly, I think we've seen three historical periods of democracy.
Yeah, you talk about the assembly.
Yeah, of the ancients, where the middle classes certainly played a role, although that term was not used, but where the vote was extended, the right to be a citizen was extended downwards. Under modern conditions, from the end of the 18th century, representative electoral democracy, no doubt in the cases of Britain and France, the middle classes played a critical role.
And now
at first, they were opposed to parliamentary democracy. Liberalism was anti-democratic for the best part of a century, but those middle classes plumped for parliamentary democracy. It's just possible that we're living in a period where some part of the middle classes, restless, feeling as though their class is disintegrating, are plumping for a different kind of democracy.
You call it monetary democracy.
Monetary democracy.
As in monitoring.
Yes. They're interested in fair, free, clean elections, but they're also interested in other forms of action that put pressures on parties and governments and businesses. You can see this in the Atlantic crisis of the past 5 years. In Spain, the most interesting political phenomenon is the phenomenon around Ada Colau and the platform for mortgage victims. It has become a networked movement outside the party systems, led by the middle classes, protesting against plutocrats and protesting against the general decadence of the banking and credit sector. We see a lot of experiments of this kind where they point, perhaps, I don't have a crystal ball, I wish we did. They point to a form of post-electoral democracy where elections remain important, but where public monitoring of power becomes critical.
But that, do you agree with that, Francis? Because it sounds a bit random.
Well, I think this is where John and I may disagree, because I'm not sure that this...
hoping you'd say that.
Yeah. I think he's pointing to a real phenomenon, which is that traditional political parties and electoral democracy is not necessarily the main locus of action in the mobilization of populations. And so you get this transnational networks of activists that mobilize behind a cause like, you know, people suffering from bad mortgages and this sort of thing. The problem is that I think electoral democracy exists for a good reason, because communities, democratic communities, have to make choices, and sometimes they have to make very difficult choices. You know, do we bail out Greece or do we satisfy German taxpayers? This kind of thing. And it's not clear that monitory democracy of the sort that John, you know, is speaking is actually capable of collective action that will result in actually hard decisions being made.
Well, it seemed to work in Tahrir Square.
Well, no, it didn't work in Tahrir Square. Actually, those protesters, as the protesters in Brazil, brought attention to their subject, but they basically were dispersed and the government continued to do whatever it wanted to do. And so this kind of protest is good for, I think, momentarily blocking existing instruments of power. But the big problem, and this is something my mentor Samuel Huntington, the great political scientist, frequently said, that these protest movements, these network protest movements, are good at momentary mobilization, but real political action still rests on traditional political parties.
Isn't the contradiction to that, we were talking about it on last night's show, the German Green Party, where in fact they started as a monetary movement, to use John Keane's expression, but have now become integrated into the fabric of electoral democracy.
That's a great example. This is the example of what Antonio Gramsci called the slow march through institutions. And the Greens actually made that one of their slogans, that they would move from being simply a protest movement to actually capturing seats in parliament. But they are very unusual among these movements, and nothing like that has really occurred in Turkey or in Brazil. If that happened, I would say, yes, that's the way democracy really ought to work. But I think that's been the big weakness, and that's been the weakness in the Arab Spring as well. You had all these protesters that brought down Mubarak, but they could not organize for an election.
But these monetary institutions are not just protest movement institutions. If you go back to the 1940s, where I think this age of monetary democracy was born, the birth of human rights networks, and then the growth of civil rights institutions, of judicial activism, of cross-border bioregional assemblies, the C40 group that links together global cities. I mean, these are all institutions that make democracies, when they're healthy, kaleidoscopic polities,
where
there's a constant elbowing and whistleblowing, watchdogs,
but
barking dog
aren't
institutions.
Aren't they untethered from the rest of the community? Aren't they untethered movements where, almost like Lenin in 1917 or before, you had this middle class core trying to bring a proletariat with them and failed? They had to create an authoritarian state to bring the proletariat with them.
Right.
So you've got these nice little middle class people doing all this nice little stuff, untethered from reality.
Oh, I think that's an unfair caricature. I think that
I was hoping you'd say that.
I mean, what these institutions have in common, using new media, always, some of them operating across borders and all operating around parliaments and outside of parties, what they have in common is an objection to arbitrary power. And I think it's good. A healthy, vibrant democracy is where one has a constant rough and tumble. And it's not fair to say that all of these institutions do not speak for the commonality. When the human rights groups globally inform us about what is happening in Syria, this is a matter for, if you like, global citizens. So there's something very big that has been born, I think, in actually existing democracies, and I see signs of some part of the middle classes actually favouring these mechanisms, which are good because they operate as watchdogs and guide dogs and barking dog institutions. Many of them, by the way, enfranchise a new constituency, the environment, the extension of the vote to biospheres is a very important movement tendency of our times.
Now, just before you talk brands is I just, for these, for if you've just turned on Late Night Live, that's what you're listening to with me, Norman Swan. And in our discussion about democracy, Francis Fukuyama from Stanford University and John Keane from Sydney University discussing this. Francis?
Well, look, there's been this sea change over the last generation away from traditional political parties and towards civil society organizations. And so I think a lot of what John is talking about is really this rise of global civil society. I see this all the time. My students, you know, when they graduate from the university, none of them wants to work for a traditional political party. They all want to go to some NGO, some activist group. And, you know, there's definitely a role for these organizations in terms of monitoring, checking, getting information out of there. But it tends to dissipate power. And what worries me is that you know, what a political party does is it actually aggregates all of these disparate influences. It runs an election and it gets political power so that it can actually change public policy.
So it might worry you, Francis, but what are you going to do about it? I mean, this is like a movement which is occurring. Mm-hmm. What's the way through this?
Part of it is, I guess, to change the consciousness and to get people more interested in traditional political power and traditional institutions like party. I'll just give you an example again from the United States. You had two populist movements over the last few years. One was the Tea Party on the right, and the other was the Occupy Wall Street movement. All right, they were both very anti-elitist. They both started in civil society as grassroots organization. The Tea Party then went on to basically change the face of the Republican Party in the 2010 election. They got a whole slew of their people elected to Congress, where, I mean, you may not like the effect that they've had, but they are exercising genuine political power. The Occupy movement brought attention to economic inequality, but they had no agenda of actually organizing for political action. And as a result, they've had no influence over, and I think this is the point that I was trying to make, or that you alluded to earlier. The left in the United States is absent because it cannot organize the way the right can organize.
And you argue that the absence of the left is creating an intellectual vacuum, which we're
suffering
from.
It's terrible. I mean, we've gone through this financial crisis that was really brought about by these Wall Street banks who continue to exercise this kind of power.
Some people might be quite surprised to hear Francis Fukuyama saying that.
Well, look, I mean, you have to take facts as they come, and I think it's pretty clear that, you know, that was the cause of the crisis, and it should have provoked a populist reaction on the left, but I think because everybody is so enamored of civil society in the absence of real institutional power, that anger has gotten dissipated and it's gone nowhere.
So has the left been dissipated through your monetary democracy and not exercising it through where real power lies, which is in parliamentary politics?
Well, I think that what we're seeing is a redefinition of the left. Remember that the left, as it emerged in Europe from the time of the French Revolution, took well over a century to crystallize, to define itself. And what I think is that two things are important. One is the observation of many of these monetary institutions and the middle classes involved in these institutions, they're not only middle class institutions, is the observation that elections remain important. The trouble is that states have been outflanked by, for example, big business, credit and banking institutions, and the growth of cross-border chains of power that are wholly unaccountable.
And here you and Francis are united.
Yes. So the question is what to do about that. The reinvigoration of electoral politics, no doubt, is important. And there is a very major crisis that has developed within all political parties in the Atlantic region, for example, with the loss of membership and the disaffection, public disaffection with politicians and parliaments, the sense that parliaments are disempowered. What I think the left entails is a reaggregation of sentiments, of a vision, of a democracy where elections, nothing less than free and fair elections, are envisaged, but where something much more is demanded and lived, namely that bossing and bullying in any sector by men of women, by bankers of creditors,
but look, John.
of bigots by those in favor of pluralism, That is not acceptable. And this left will not resemble, I think it's a mistake that Francis makes. He's imagining that the left will be reborn of the 19th century kind. I think it's going to be much more kaleidoscopic.
Francis? Well,
yeah, I mean, it'll be kaleidoscopic and weak. I mean, basically, if you want to deal with out-of-control finance, it is only the state that's going to fix this problem. The state, through its regulatory power in the United States, the solution to the too-big-to-fail problem of these large banks should have been the government nationalizing them, breaking them up, and then going back to the old regulatory regime that prevented them from getting as large as they are. Only the state has the power to do that. And in the United States, the state has really been mastered by the financial sector, so that as a result of campaign contributions and this incredible lobbying machine that Wall Street has, the American government is not powerful enough to correct this situation. And I'm sorry, but you know, this dissipated monetary left is wasting its energy, because unless you get a consensus behind a strong set of state regulations, you're not going to fix this problem of
finance.
But how do you
explain the weakness of the Republican Party? Some would argue as a result of the Tea Party movement, and the strength of, if you call it a party of the left, the Democrats.
Well, the two are different phenomena. I think the problem with the Republican Party is that it's been captured by its right wing, and so a lot of the centrist or center-right Republicans, it used to be...
But in a sense, it's been captured by this monetary movement who complains about this plutocracy.
Well, right, and look, I don't like the agenda of this group, but what I'm saying is they went from being a civil society organization to being an organized political force because they had the organizational skills to do that. And that's what I'm saying all political groups need and what the left has really not been able to achieve.
So, John, your recipe seems to me to lead to a single party state, almost like China, where you've got these fragmented left-wing or community-based organizations arguing on single issues, pushing it in certain directions.
No, not at all. No, I think...
Where does the second party come from then?
Let me go back. And this is something of a comment on Francis's remarks about the weakness of these institutions. If you look at the post-1945 period, every major public issue that had universal resonance was born of scrutiny mechanisms, network monetary bodies that subsequently had an impact on government. In order, the marriage of human rights and democracy that happened at the end of the 40s and the birth of the civil rights movement, peace against nuclear weapons, the student movement, the rebirth of the women's movement, the greening of politics, the politics of disability, all of these grand, great ideas and the politics that flowed from them began outside the party system and parliaments and official politics. Now, it's true that laws have to be passed and budgets have to be drawn up and governments have to intervene, yes. But as I see it in this age of monetary democracy, the dynamism has shifted to outside the party systems, and that is not going to wither away. So the vision is not a one-party state. Democracy means that wherever power is exercised in the name of equality of citizens, it is restrained, it's chastened. That's a very abstract way of putting it, which means that democracy, one of the great challenges of 21st century democratic ideals and for Democrats, is how to invent mechanisms for dealing with cross-border chains of power, which are wrecking democracies. And if you take the case of Europe and the banking and credit sector, it's cross-border, but there are no mechanisms for actually dealing with it.
But I still can't see an alternative to endless coalitions in Parliament representing these various... I mean, at the moment, it's the Greens in Australia that kind of are the collecting bag, if you like, for a lot of these monetary movements.
It's a kind
Australia.
Of anti-party party. It has roots in civil society and it operates in...
But they're not very effective. They're just shut from the sidelines.
National broadband, carbon emissions restrictions, the greening of the middle classes, they have helped to popularize these trends, and these will not go away.
Well, if I could say, I think one of the weaknesses of the left globally, and I certainly see this back in the United States is the fact that actually all of this motley coalition of different groups has focused the left's agenda, or it's dissipated again the left's agenda on identity politics. And so, you know, feminist groups want one thing, the gays want something else, the ethnic groups all want something else. And it's taken the focus away from the old economic issues, which is where we started with.
In the few minutes that's left to us, let's actually tackle that, because it's common ground between the two of you. You argue, Francis, that we've created a plutocracy. It's, you know, government for the rich, by the rich. And this globalized phenomenon has shrunk the middle class, and that's the threat you see. So what's the solution here? Re-regulation at state level? Reinvigoration of manufacturing industry? What are the key elements that need to be put in place by national governments, albeit we seem a million miles away from that at the moment, at least in parliamentary politics in Australia?
Well, I think that there are different components to it. So part of it really just requires focusing on this regulatory problem, which is, I think, the problem we suffer from in the United States of a kind of oligarchy who exercise undue influence in politics. The question of middle-class job disappearance is a much, much tougher issue to deal with through public policy, because it's driven relentlessly by things that we can't really control, like the advance of computer technology. The traditional solution...
Well, and emerging nations with
and,
cheap
and globalization.
Labor pools.
Yeah, I mean, it's all part of the same, I think, technology-driven, you know, set of developments. There, I think the traditional solution has been education. So you keep moving people up into higher skill categories so that they can stay ahead of this machine. And there are big problems with that, because there are, I think, first of all, limits to, you know, the degree to which you can educate a redundant 50-year-old worker in a traditional manufacturing job to do, you know, a higher skill occupation. There are limits to education reform. We put a lot of money into the system and it doesn't actually produce results. And then finally, it you know, doesn't solve the underlying treadmill problem.
So where does is it simply regulation of the financial services sector? Is that
well? No. So that's just a start. I mean, that's the beginning of solving one very specific vulnerability we have, which is this boom bust cycle that's created by modern finance. But the tougher real issue is how to deal with technology. And you know, I think that if you look across the developed world, just to bring this to kind of pragmatic realities, some countries have done this better. So the Germans and the Scandinavians right now, their model actually looks a lot better than this kind of Anglo-liberal model, because they have a corporatist approach to wages. They negotiate. There's a high trust relationship with their labor unions. They protect the wages of working class individuals. They keep up the manufacturing skills through an apprenticeship program. All of these things are not done in Britain or the United States. And I think...
So they narrow the band between rich and poor.
And it doesn't solve the problem in the long run, but it does, you know, it's meant that Germany's been able to keep much more of its manufacturing sector than Britain or the United States have.
John?
I accept most of that, but I think what's missing is protection of the internet. On a common ownership basis, I think that's emerging as a very important middle class and universal concern. The dignity and empowerment of women, unfinished business. I think biodegradation is a serious problem and underestimated in this account. It cannot be here on growth for growth's sake, because actually there are whole sections of the middle classes globally who think there's more to life than money. I think as well... that the development of cross-border mechanisms is hugely important. We are at a very early stage.
Or restriction or regulation?
The regulation, to be sure, but that means building new mechanisms.
Cross-border money flows, or what are you talking about?
We do not have a global mechanism for constraining hot money flows, which are so destabilizing. There is a lot of unfinished business in that, and the middle classes will play a role in this. As far as domestics are concerned, my favorite example from the European region in the last 5 years is the Icelandic model.
you have to be kidding me.
Monetary democracy in action. The banks were allowed to collapse. The culprits were arrested. A prime minister was arrested. There was a change of government. even a best party, as it was called, won representation. It stood for the principle that no party ever tells the truth, so we're not going to tell the truth. No party ever honours its promises, so we are not going to honour our promises. And better public transport came of it, a middle class that actually was rescued from oblivion. Now, Iceland is Iceland, it's a very small country, but that kind of politics is badly needed in so many European democracies, which are on the skids. If you look at Greece and Spain and Italy, and if you look at Romania and Bulgaria and so on, what we're seeing is a kind of Putinism. We're seeing a kind of drift to authoritarian dictatorship, which is rather reminiscent of the 20s and 30s.
And Italy is Italy is the example. You had that attempt of a third party in Italy, which has kind of gone nowhere. They got a reasonable percentage.
Well, it's gone nowhere because the Five Star Movement was anti-political. And, you know, they simply wanted to remain dispersed civil society actors with no common agenda and therefore no possibility of common collective actions.
Led by a demagogue who actually was a kind of replica of Berlusconi. And it's a great tragedy for Italy. Ask young Italians who want to leave the country in droves.
So, dear listener, you're going to have to make up your own mind about this and September coming close. Look, can I thank you both? It's been a fascinating conversation. Francis Fukuyama from Stanford University, John Keane from the University of Sydney. We'll have their publications up on our web, and that's the program for today. You can visit our website to get more information. That's abc.net.au/Radio National. Look for Late Night Live. Tomorrow on Late Night Live, another Scotsman, the author Andrew O'Hagan, on one of the most compelling themes of his writing, the crimes committed against and sometimes by children. So that's it for now. Stick around on RN and I'll see you later.